This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. Is incremental change better than no change? When you ask that question, on paper at least, the answer seems obvious. Something is generally better than nothing. But we live in a country of single-issue voters, and an electorate that's generally more excited by principles than execution. Think of the Bernie Bros of 2016. For a lot of progressives, political purity matters, and it is all or nothing. So, is purity practical? Or do we shoot ourselves in the foot by writing off anyone we sorta disagree with?
I see politics as the way to advance on the issues that I care about. And if I can't get it all right then, I am gonna take what I can get.
Shaniqua McClendon of Crooked Media joins Hear Me Out in just a moment. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. For a presidential election year, a good chunk of the country is remarkably unconcerned when it comes to electability. The Republican primary is, for all intents and purposes, uncontested, and exit poll after exit poll makes it clear that Trump voters don't care so much about electability or the ability to beat Joe Biden, at least not as much as they care about values, what their candidate stands for, or at least claims to stand for, and whether it aligns with what they care about. And really, this is a more common phenomenon on the left. The progressive movement leans toward uncompromising progress. Just look at the increasingly loud liberal voters who are abandoning Joe Biden solely because of his handling of the war in Gaza, or the people who would only accept all student loans forgiven or nothing at all. We talked recently on this show about horse race journalism, and a big part of that discussion was about the kind of coverage voters really want to see or hear, issues, or who's going to win. So if, in fact, a good chunk of the electorate is voting on values, what does that mean? What does it mean about those voters? Our guest today argues that this ideological purity complex is a product of privilege, and it might be undermining the whole reason we elect politicians to begin with. That guest is Shaniqua McClendon, Vice President of Politics for Crooked Media. Hi there, Shaniqua.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
First, for those who don't know Crooked Media, what is that?
So Crooked Media is what we call a progressive media company. I used to just call it a progressive podcast company, but now I call it a progressive media company. A big part of what we do is similar to news organizations. We put information out there. We educate people about what's going on in politics. The difference is we don't want to just tell people what's wrong. We want to tell them what they can do to fix the things that they care about. And that is actually why I got hired. I run our political department. And how I describe it is we pull people in through the continent and then we push them over to Vote Save America so that they can tap in and do something. And Vote Save America feels like my little baby. It'll be six this year. And it's been tremendous. In 5.5 years, raised $55 million for progressive organizations and candidates, and have mobilized over 600,000 voters, volunteers, and donors. So it's just been amazing. The last thing I'll say, it's just been great that we've told our audience, if you care about something and you get involved, you can have an impact, and, it keeps happening. So we're going to help it keep going.
I'm all for reducing cynicism about government and about politics.
It's
so
hard.
If you guys are achieving that, it's not easy. But if you guys are achieving that in some way, I'm all for it. The opinion that you're bringing us to us today, though, is about ideological purity. And I'll let you give us sort of the elevator, the brief summary of what this opinion is, what your view of this is. I think a lot of people know what moral purity is, but tell us about ideological purity in politics.
Yeah, the way I kind of define it is a belief that if our elected leaders don't always uphold the ideologically purest version of a policy position, then they are not actually committed to the values they say they stand for. And so I think a perfect example is the Democratic primary in 2020, where healthcare was a really big part of the conversation. But what it seemed like to me was if you were not supportive of Medicare for All, but maybe if you did not think it was feasible in our current political climate, that you did not care about people having access to healthcare, which I just don't think is true of any of the Democratic candidates who were running. I think all of them wanted people to have access to healthcare. And yeah, you can't always just make things happen because you want to will them into existence.
Okay, so give us an example, because I'll tell you what, when you're talking about ideological purity, I actually don't think about conservatives. The reason is because often in recent years, at least, well, recent, in the past half century, many conservative voters have put all of their emphasis on one thing. It's often abortion.
Yes.
In the past 50 years, and they will put up with anything else, if as long as that candidate agrees with them on abortion. That's not ideological purity, is it?
No, because they put up with a lot. You know, honestly, the reason I get so frustrated when people are like, no, this is where you have to be on all these things, or it's the only way I'm going to support you, is you sacrifice a lot of progress when you do that. Now, we should, of course, have parameters around what we're willing to accept and what we're not willing to accept. I think on abortion, conservatives have been willing to accept a whole lot.
A lot.
Grab
her by the pussy, yeah. A lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Try to overthrow the government a lot. And, you know, a lot of them are still just like, well, you know, we were able to get Roe overturned. But
it worked. Yeah.
Yeah, it did. Exactly. And so now I wouldn't sacrifice that much. But the way I look at it is you have your beliefs. I think people should absolutely believe things. They should feel, you know, if they feel strongly about it, have those convictions. But when I think about politics, I'm thinking about progress. And I see politics as the way to advance on the issues that I care about. And if I can't get it all right then, I am going to take what I can get. I know people do not like to hear about incrementalism. I know that's like a dirty word.
Yes.
But people benefit in the increments. There are a lot of people, and this is where what gets to the privilege piece. Going back to abortion, we saw limited bans on, you know, 15-week ban down to 16-week ban. They were willing to take the steps to get closer and closer, which they're not fully there yet. Hopefully we will not get there. But they are willing to do 20-week, 15-week, 5-week, and then no abortions at all. And then, you know, no abortion pills, no contraception. They are willing to take those increments. And I'm sure that...
No IVF, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that, you know, looking at it now, there are a lot of Democrats, myself included, who are really angry that we are where we are. But they were willing to take those small steps to get where we are. And now they're happy. And if we were willing to do that, I think we could see more progress on other things. But we get caught up in these fights about not being in the perfect position, even though being in the perfect position means nothing if you have to put it through a Congress that has a bunch of Republicans.
Yeah. So when we talk about, just to be clear, when we talk about ideological purity, especially in this cycle, in the 2024 presidential election, most people are talking about the Democrats. Now, I'm an independent, but most people are when they say this, they're talking about the purity test of Democrats. So, I mean, that immediately brings to mind like a Bernie bro, right? Somebody who refused to vote for Hillary Clinton because they wanted Bernie Sanders instead. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's both. It's like the Bernie question is layered for me because I spent 6 years working on Capitol Hill, very much understand how the sausage is made. And he had a lot of great ideas, but the feasibility of a lot of his ideas actually becoming law, very low. And so specifically,
also, if I could throw in something here, he has a long history in the Senate, which is one of the most powerful seats in all of government, and never got anything done.
Exactly.
So again, as a journalist, I had a lot of reservations about whether he would be able to accomplish any of that.
Exactly.
But go continue.
Yeah, no, but that's my point. With purity politics, it's often in theory. It's often academic, and it's where people feel good. And it's all about just, you know, demonstrating to the world, this is where I stand. This is the purest position for me to be. But then we're never going to get there if the only thing you will take is that thing. because similar to abortion, there was never going to be a time where the Roe decision came down and then we were immediately going to just go to the overturning of Roe. It was popular. Yeah. So they had to eat away at it. And that's a negative framing of it. But even as we think about progress, you know, maybe instead of eating away at it, we have to inch toward it. But going back to Bernie Sanders, and I don't blame him. Actually, I think politicians should be honest about it.
I kind of blame him.
Yeah. They should be honest about the way that they plan to get things done. I do think that is something that Elizabeth Warren did a good job on. And people would say, well, they're the same. Why wouldn't you just like both of them? Process matters. That was the first thing I learned on Capitol Hill. Process matters, and it's a political tool to get things done. And someone who's been in the Senate as long as him should know how to maneuver to get some of those things done. But it also, I think, pulled in a lot of people who don't have a full understanding of how our government works into thinking that you could just, I don't know, the president can just do whatever they want. And they can sign any bills into law and we just get whatever we want, even if, you know, half the Congress. And honestly, with a lot of the stuff Bernie Sanders wanted, most of the Congress did not agree with. So how are these things ever going to actually become law?
But here's the thing. To a certain extent, it makes sense to me that you'd be saying this. You're a Black woman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Black woman.
Mm-hmm.
Going back through the history of America, Black women have always endorsed incrementalism.
Yeah.
they've been very practical about voting for candidates that they 49% didn't agree with because they were at least a step in the right direction. That has been true of African American women in particular.
Yeah.
For a very, very long time, well before they had suffrage. On the other hand, this label of purity politics has also been put on reformers and those who are pushing for progression in a negative way. Like, that has been used to prevent progress, this label of purity.
When I'm talking about purity politics, I am speaking more in like an electoral sense. I do think that we need people pushing from the outside, because the only reason, for instance, Joe Biden had passed some of the progressive policies that he's passed is because there were people who said, this is what we need. Specifically thinking about student loans. I think student loans is something Joe Biden did not want to do at all. I don't think he believed that it was something that should happen and that people should pay off their loans because they took them out. And, you know, I went to Harvard for grad school, and I still remember when he said, if you went to an Ivy League school, you should not get your loans forgiven. I grew up poor. I still have six figures in loans from Harvard. So it's hard for me. It's allowed me to have this great job that I love, but the people who don't have loans were rich already. And so I think he has like a fundamental misunderstanding of how any of this works, but he was pushed because you had activists, you had people in the Senate, like Senator Warren, pushing for this. Obviously the Supreme Court struck down the forgiveness, but
let's
put that aside for a second. We had some people saying, forgive all the debt that people have. No one should have debt for going to college. Then I'm sure there are people in between there and 50,000, but then we get to 50,000 and then we get to 10,000. And we, you know, I think what the activists did was push him to have a conversation about what amount is feasible. I think now seeing where it ended up, 50,000 is, he probably didn't feel comfortable doing that because they struck down the 10,000 and forgiving all of it, that would have been unpopular just generally. But once we get to the point where we're having a conversation about forgiving student loans, at that point, if people would have said, no, it's all or nothing, we would have gotten nothing. And so now we get to a point where, no, it wasn't everything. No, it wasn't 50,000. Is 10,000 great for my six-figure loans? No, but it is something. And it's 10,000 more dollars that I don't have to pay that doesn't have compounded daily interest on it. And so, again, that's incremental, but it is a value. I know I'm in the minority with six figures in student loans. There's a lot of people who $10,000 would wipe out their student loan debt, and it would be half of it. It would be significant for them. And so in what world would I say all or nothing when people will actually be helped in the process? And so I do think it's important to have people pushing the conversation as far as we can get it. And the fact that they are having conversations about forgiving all of people's student debt gets us there. But when it's actually time to pass a policy, I don't think that's the point at which you
say no. All or nothing.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, I'm going to ask about the times that this has gone wrong, horribly wrong, in electoral politics. We're talking about the purity test of politics, and we'll talk more after a break. This is Hear Me Out. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Welcome back. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. I'm Celeste Headlee, and with me today from Crooked Media is Shaniqua McClendon, who says that ideological purity is harming progressivism. So I just want to point out there have been times in electoral politics where, you know, look, I'm Black and Jewish, where my people have voted for someone who at least matched some of the criteria they wanted, and then ended up being absolutely horrible. We talked with David Frum about Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson said some of the right things. And in comparison with others, right, my ancestors thought he was the lesser of a couple evils. Would it have been different if they insisted on a more extreme test of friendliness? I don't know. They ended up getting a rampant racist in the White House.
Okay. I don't think lesser of two evils and getting all the progress you can get are the same things. Okay, I'm going to use some numbers just because that helps me, like, okay, kind of contextualizing.
If you content warning, she's going to use numbers. Okay, go ahead.
If you lesser of two evils could mean you get, like, you go from 0 to -2 or -3 with your two choices. That is not forward moving at all. But if you have two people and one of them takes you to 1 and the other one takes you to 3, but your goal is 10, I want the person who's going to take me to 3. I don't want to go backwards at all. So someone taking me to -1 or -2, that's the same to me because I'm losing something in that. But going the other way, I'm getting something. And so I want progress to be part of it. So I don't personally think I've ever voted in an election where I was actually voting for the lesser of two evils. I do believe that I've voted for in elections where I wasn't particularly super happy about both candidates, but I did feel like one would advance the things that were important to me.
Okay, so I'm thinking about Barack Obama's first year or two in office, when he was trying to get the Affordable Health Care Act passed.
Yeah.
And landmark piece of legislation, absolutely.
Yep.
But it does represent a lot of compromises.
Yes. Yeah.
And it represents a lot of compromises at a time when the Democrats controlled all of Congress.
Yes.
Isn't there an argument to be made that he should have insisted upon a little bit more of a purity, that he shouldn't have made all those compromises?
I think people forget we had, like, true moderate, like, somewhat conservative Democrats in Congress at that time. Like, they were the problem. I mean, we literally had all the this huge majority and still couldn't get these things done, and there were Democrats standing in the way. And so that sucks. I mean, you know, it's the same thing we saw with Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Like, sometimes you just have people who are in the party who are not helpful. And so then again, I actually think this underscores my point. You get what you can. You know, I actually started working on the Hill in August of 2010, and I was interning at the White House when the Affordable Care Act got passed. And, you know, I think implementation was probably seemed.
It was
everyone
chaotic.
Was mad. Yes, it felt more chaotic than the actual bill being passed. But seeing that process happen and seeing how frustrated people got, and I was interning in the Office of Presidential Correspondence. So people were writing in and they were like pissed off. I mean, on both sides, but it's still more than what we had before. And especially because you think of how many iterations there have been of someone trying to pass universal health care in the United States. He actually got something passed. The Congress actually got something passed. And, you know, this is, sorry, I was about to say shame on the Democrats who like watered down the bill. But we can't do anything about that. These people were truly moderates. They felt like they were representing their constituents. And I mean, politics was involved, too. But I still think the country's better off for it.
And racism was involved, let's be honest.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
But would we have Joe Biden as president if we weren't overly concerned about electability? Like, would Hillary Clinton have been the candidate if, and again, I'm an independent, but Democrats are often very concerned with electability. And we've mentioned several times that conservatives are sort of like one issue voters and not concerned about electability. But, you know, one of the reasons Joe Biden ended up being the candidate as opposed to Elizabeth Warren or Mayor Pete or whomever is because people got so worried that none of the other candidates would be electable that they preemptively, you know, ratcheted down.
I think that could be the case for some, maybe a lot of people. I think that is definitely, and I'm not one to say the media is dictating what we think. I do think that is part of, you know, a media narrative. But also, I think there are people who actually believe that and voted believing that other people would be thinking that when they went into the voting booth. But I also, I was talking to a friend about this the other day. Everyone I know voted for Elizabeth Warren. She did not make it very far, which says a lot about the bubble that I'm in. And so I do think people's feelings about electability is a part of it. But I also think a lot of the country actually liked Joe Biden. My grandmother loves Joe Biden. Like, a lot of the older Black people I know love Joe Biden. He won the primary. He was also Barack Obama's vice president. So people knew him. And so it's hard for me to, like, I think all of that goes into it. And obviously, you know, name recognition is part of being electable. But I guess I don't. Yeah, 2020 was such a specific instance because Donald Trump was like, everyone was scared. But I think
everyone was scared. But also, look, Shaniqua, when you talk about electability, anytime that you bring up electability or likability, women suffer. Candidates of,
yes,
of color,
yes,
suffer.
Yes, I agree. I completely agree.
Because the most electable candidates
is a white
are
guy.
White guys over 6 feet tall. That is the most electable candidate in the United States.
Yeah. That's something I struggle with a lot because it is the truth, but this country is racist and sexist. And so, you know, how do you force? I can't even believe these words are coming out of my mouth. Like, but how do you get a country that's racist and sexist to support someone who's not a white man? And, you know, what I always think is so interesting is the 2008 primary, because I was just like, wow, there's a white woman and a Black man. Let's see who's going to win this battle. And the man still won. I mean, now I did vote for Barack Obama.
I also did not. I did not think Barack Obama was going to.
Me either.
I really did not think.
That was my first presidential election I got to vote in. And I went into that booth and said, he's going to lose, but he'll have my vote. And I was in North Carolina and he won the state. Both, you know, obviously the primary and the general.
But again, when we're talking about electability, When we talk about not using a purity test, that made the Republicans end up with Donald Trump, right? And many Republicans think that was an absolute disaster. It could very well be. We still don't know at this point, but Donald Trump's election could be sort of the dissolution of the Republican Party. We still don't know if the Republican Party will survive this.
I know. I mean, yeah, I'd say they also, you know, obviously there's factions of the Republican Party, but, you know, I think taxes are the other part. I think there's a lot of rich Republicans who actually don't care about abortion. They probably want it to still be intact, but maybe they're just, it's funny. Going back to the privilege part of this, I think there's some selfishness and individualism on the Republican side. And I do think there's more collectivism on the Democratic side. But going back to the privilege piece, like a lot of what I hear when I hear people who are kind of engaging in purity politics is, well, I'm speaking up for those whose voices are not heard and like all of this. And I guarantee you, if you spoke to someone whose voice was not heard and they had to choose between getting the Affordable Care Act or, you know, a version of that with universal health care, they'd take whichever one they could get. And that's why I feel like this is such a privileged thing to kind of stand in, because when you don't benefit from the incremental change, it means you have a lot. And who are you to demand that we get everything or nothing and not acknowledge the people who are sacrificed in that time? Going back to the Affordable Care Act, who stayed alive because we had the Affordable Care Act and didn't say it's all or nothing? There's a lot of people who are literally probably still alive in that. And that's, you know, I think people should have conviction about the things that they believe in. But I just know that there are people who look like me who get sacrificed in these conversations of all or nothing.
Okay, we have to take another break, but I feel like we've gotten to a really interesting point. So I'm anxious to come back. Stay with us. This is Hear Me Out.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this for me is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
We're back. It's Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate, and we're talking about ideological purity when it comes to electing a presidential candidate. To a certain extent, I feel like let's go back to, say, the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. But he was an incremental change, right? Like, mm-hmm. He had no desire to end slavery when he became president.
Yeah.
So I feel like his election supports your argument. He didn't, for abolitionists, he did not pass the purity test. And yet they still ended up getting what they wanted. On the other hand, prior to his election, you had all kinds of people calling the abolitionists crazy and fanaticists and neurotic because they insisted that nothing short of abolition was enough. And I wonder if if that counts for you, because they weren't talking about presidential candidates per se. I mean, maybe they fit more in line with the recent Republicans, in that they took that one issue and just stuck with it over time.
Okay. So I see the abolitionists the way I describe the activists pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing.
I see.
But if when Abraham Lincoln said, this is what I can do, they said, that's not enough. Like, who are they to say about the lives of enslaved people, you can't get anything because it's not enough for us? I don't like purity politics, but the real core of this are the people who engage in it.
So give me an example. Give me an example of how that's working right now. Like what? Obviously, you have seen some political discourse leading up to this election. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind to me is that those who are not, who say they won't vote for Joe Biden because of how he's handling the war in Gaza. Does that count?
I want to like be sensitive here. I don't think that being upset with a politician on what they're doing is purity politics. Like people used to get mad at me because I criticized Barack Obama all the time.
There's plenty to criticize.
And I think we should be able to criticize our leaders. Gaza's obviously like, it's bad. I think Joe Biden needs to, I mean, obviously call for a permanent ceasefire, but literally like we can put strings on the money that we're giving to Israel. We don't have to allow them to do whatever they want. But this is an interesting one because I'm thinking now about Ukraine and Russia and Israel and Gaza. And I was talking to a friend about this last night, and we were talking about like what would, on us on the progressive side, what would a progressive foreign policy, you know, look like? National security policy look like? Because in my head, unless I'm wrong, diplomacy would be the only way to handle things if we had like a very pure progressive national security agenda. But you think about someone like Vladimir Putin, I don't think there's any form of diplomacy that he would respond to. I mean, the sanctions aren't.
And diplomacy wouldn't have prevented the Hamas terrorist attack on the music festival.
No, it wouldn't have. But So on the Ukraine side, I don't think there's any form of diplomacy that would stop Putin.
I agree
that diplomacy won't work on Hamas. But that doesn't mean that it won't work on Netanyahu. And 30,000 people being dead, there's got to be another way. And I'm not an expert on the Middle East. I recognize that most people are advocating for a two-state solution. And I recognize that there are people in Israel who feel like they will not be safe under a two-state solution. But there are also Palestinians who don't feel safe right now. And I mean, they're being bombed. 30,000 people have died. And so I agree with you that diplomacy would not have stopped the October 7th attack. And I don't think diplomacy works on terrorists. With that said, Joe Biden does have some strings he can pull with Netanyahu so that he will figure out something that he can do that is better than this. And again, I'm not an expert here, but back to the purity politics piece. I don't think that calling Joe Biden out for that is bad. I think we should. I don't think it's purity politics to want him to do better. I think all of our presidents...
What if you don't vote for him because of it?
So that is where I get back to what I was saying earlier about moving forward versus moving back. And as bad as I think things are, I do not believe that Donald Trump is going to put Palestinians in a better place. That's just like point blank period. You know, there was coverage of Israeli political leaders saying that if Trump was just in office, they wouldn't have to deal with all this resistance. And it's not that much resistance from us. And they, you know, referring to it like it's a lot. Now, that does not bring comfort to the people who have lost loved ones. I know that. And politics is not always a space where you can make people feel warm and fuzzy. And maybe I've worked in politics too long and lost the warm and fuzzies part, but one candidate's going to do this, the other's going to do that.
Now, I will say, Shaniqua, right before, you know, we only have about a minute left, but we have plenty of listeners who support Donald Trump, who are Republicans.
Okay.
Is this issue that you're talking about, is it only a progressive issue? I mean, you're talking about incrementalism being better for progress than purity. Is that solely a message for Democrats?
Well, my familiarity and working in politics is that Republicans are typically trying to keep the status quo or take us back to a time where white people, men, had all the power. And so I just don't see what they're fighting for as moving forward. And if I can't see it as moving forward, then progress isn't part of it.
I know a a lot of you have thoughts on this. I would really be interested in hearing from people on the right who have been maybe single issue voters in the past. Maybe you have put up with a lot of things you don't like in a candidate because they align with you on your most important value. Or maybe people on the left. You know, I'd love to hear from a Bernie bro. Give me the argument for why a purity test is worthwhile. Love to hear that. Whatever your thoughts are, I know you're having them and I want to hear them. A couple weeks ago, we discussed horse race journalism with Chris Siliza. We got some great comments on that show. So before we go, here's one of them. A listener named Tito wrote this. You and Chris did a fantastic job describing how matters are covered by journalists preceding, during, and beyond the campaign period. I lean on the side that journalism is the root of the degradation of modern-day electioneering. That's rough, Tito. And the lack of objectivity of how hot topic issues are covered. For instance, the issue of the border, which peaks at election time. This issue has been weaponized due to journalists reporting on it and contributing to grossly misleading and misinforming the public by playing to emotion, then facts. First of all, thank you, Tito. Rough, but fair. I will say that I'm not sure the issue, in my opinion, was weaponized by journalists. I think that it comes up during election time because politicians find it very easy to stoke people's fears by talking about foreigners, the others from outside our country and invading. I do think it's fair to say that we don't have to cover that if we don't want to. I think that's absolutely correct. But we love hearing these comments from you. Thank you to everyone who sends in your comments and responses. We read all of them, even if we can't read them over the air. Our email address is hearmeout@slate.com. We know you have thoughts to share, so keep them coming. Hear Me Out is a podcast from Slate. The show is produced by Maura Curry. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations. And Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Slate Audio. I am your host, Celeste Headley. Until next time, speak your mind, but keep it open.